Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this day back in 2014 that who became the first to perform a concert on all seven of Earth's continents? Hint, the performance on this day was held at the Argentine Carlini Station in Antarctica. So, 2014. Was that A, Paul McCartney? B, Metallica? C, Leonard Bernstein? Or D, Garth Brooks? All seven continents. Who was that performer? And question number two, it was on this day back in 1960 that singer Fabian visited Elvis Presley at Graceland and did something unusual. What was it that he did on this day and why? Was it A, he performed the song Hound Dog while dressed as a dog to celebrate the song's anniversary? Or was it B, he gave Elvis a gift of 1,960 moon pies in honor of the year of his visit? Or was it C, he lent Elvis his pants because Elvis had ripped his demonstrating karate? Or was it D, drove a gold Edsel onto the front steps of Elvis's home to advertise the superior qualities of this car compared to Elvis's gold Cadillac? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com. And today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of December the 6th. Well, it was on this day, back in 1865, that composer Jean Johann Julius Christian Sibelius was born. This Finnish composer is perhaps best known for the tone poem Finlandia. And it was 39 years ago today, 1980, in New York City, that Mark David Chapman shot John Lennon to death. Earlier in the day, Lennon had autographed an album for Chapman. And in country music news, we have this article entitled, The Grand Ole Opry's Anniversary, Five Musical Milestones. This is written by Stephen L. Betts, published on the 28th of November, 2019, Rolling Stone magazine. On November 28, 1925, 94 years ago this week, the WSM Barn Dance was born. Fashioned after the already popular National Barn Dance, which premiered in April 1924 on Chicago radio station WLS, the show would later be christened the Grand Ole Opry. After host George D. Hay noted that a slate of performers playing hillbilly music, fiddle tunes, and the like would follow a just-completed classical music program. On a Saturday night in 1927, Hay told the radio audience, "For the next 3 hours, we will present nothing but realism. We will be down to earth for the earthy. We have heard grand opera from New York, but now we will be listening to the Grand Old Opry. Countless musical memories have since been experienced on its legendary stages, from the WSM studios and the Dixie Tabernacle to the Ryman Auditorium and today's modern Grand Old Opry House. Here are the stories behind five of our favorites. Hank Williams' Opry debut. By June 1949, Hank Williams, who had been a frequent performer on the Louisiana Hayride in Shreveport, was becoming a huge star nationally. On June the 11th, he made his way to Nashville, where he would appear on the Opry for the first time during Saturday night's 9:30 portion. Hosted by Ernest Tubb. Sandwiched between performances by Opry mainstays Bill Monroe and the Crook Brothers, Williams' first song was Lovesick Blues, one he didn't write. Although it's the subject of some debate by most accounts, the enthusiastic audience was immediately treated to an astonishing six encores from the singer. The Opry program notes that the first of his songs he performed was Mind Your Own Business, soon to be a hit. Williams took the Opry stage again the following week and became one of the radio show's most popular cast members. Sadly, his battle with alcohol led to his firing from the program in August 1952. While the Opry contended the move as a wake-up call to the beleaguered entertainer, he never returned. 4 months later, he was dead from heart failure at just 29 years old. Jerry Lee Lewis's Breaks the Rules. Let me tell you something about Jerry Lee Lewis, ladies and gentlemen. I do a rock and roll and country and western and rhythm and blues singing. With those words, uttered from the Ryman stage on January 20th, 1973, the music icon known as the Killer broke one Opry rule, no cursing on stage. Soon enough, he'd lay waste to another. A request not to perform any of his rock songs. After a single country hit, Another Place, Another Time, one of the songs that resurrected his foundering career and changed his musical direction, he proceeded to deliver a 40-minute set instead of the generally allotted two songs per act that included rock classics like Whole Lotta Lovin', Whole Lotta Shakin' Goin' On, and Great Balls of Fire. The Birth of Bluegrass. In 1926, a band called the Bluegrass Serenaders appeared on the Opry, making the first time a group with bluegrass in their name would play the Opry stage. They were actually an old-time string band. When Kentucky-born Bill Monroe joined the Opry in 1939, he was accompanied by his band, the Bluegrass Boys, named after Kentucky's nickname. By December 1945, Monroe had recruited banjo player Earl Scruggs, who picked with a fiery and innovative three-fingered style, as well as skilled guitarist and lead vocalist Lester Flatt. This extraordinary combination, a highlight of Opry shows and a popular touring act, would be credited with inventing the genre, playing what musicologist Alan Lomax would refer to as folk music in overdrive. Today, bluegrass is represented on the Opry by members including Alison Krauss and Dale McCurry. Then there was the Long-Haired Hippies, the Birds Land on Stage. Culture clashes are a rare thing on the Opry stage, but in the late 60s and throughout the 70s, as the Opry outgrew the Ryman Auditorium and country music evolved, not every invitation issued to special guest performers was greeted with enthusiasm by the more musically conservative fan base. On March the 15th, 1968, folk rockers The Birds with new member Graham Parsons were in Nashville for the final day of recording their roots-influenced Sweetheart of the Rodeo LP, and that night, The Birds performed a cover of Merle Haggard's Sing Me Back Home. Mocked for their long hair, which they'd actually had cut for the occasion, with some in the audience deriding them with bird calls, they ditched another planned Haggard cover, Life in Prison, to perform the Parsons' original Hickory Wind as a tribute to the singer-songwriter's grandmother. It was a risky move that defied protocol and further PO'd a number of Opry cast members. And finally, the godfather of soul goes country. Although piano player Del Wood had performed with rocker Jerry Lee Lewis 6 years earlier, in March 1979 she wanted no part of another upcoming event that would cross musical genres, the appearance of Soul Brother No. 1, James Brown. "I could throw up," Wood told the Nashville Banner at the time. "The next thing you know, they'll be doing the strip out there." While longtime Opry member Jean Shepherd announced she would boycott that night's show in protest, it was Opry legend Porter Wagoner who issued Brown the invite while he was in Music City recording. Then came Brown's 8-song set, 5 of which were among his soul hits, including an extended version of Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. While the 30-minute set leaned heavily on Brown's R&B classics, he also performed a trio of country-esque tunes, "You're Cheatin' Heart," "Tennessee Waltz," and "Georgia on My Mind." In spite of the media attention and vocal protests, Brown would later insist he had been treated like a prodigal son during his Opry visit. 6 months later, another R&B icon, Stevie Wonder, visited Nashville and performed on the Grand Ole Opry singing Charlie Rich's Behind Closed Doors. His appearance, however, was not accompanied by the same negative publicity. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled, "Stores Are Using Music to Make You Spend More. Here's How." This is written by Eric Devaney, published in ThinkGrowth.com on the 7th of January, 2016. The practice of designing store environments in order to project a certain image and induce certain behavior is known as atmospherics, a term coined by business professor Philip Kotler in 1973. According to Kotler, in addition to helping stores attract and maintain a targeted customer base, atmospherics has the potential to be more important for generating sales than the actual products on the shelves. To quote from his 1973 Journal of Retailing article, "In some cases, the place, more specifically the atmosphere of the place, is more influential than the product itself in the purchase decision. In some cases, the atmosphere is the primary product. For the purposes of this story, we're going to hone in on one of the sensory details of stimuli that retailers use in atmospheric design, sound. Specifically, we'll explore how stores use different aspects of sound and music to trigger different behaviors, including the elusive, I want to spend more money, behavior. Volume. There's a big rule that retailers often don't understand, which is that music on top of noise is generally just more noise. It's like putting perfume on a bad smell. You just get a worse smell. A decade before Kotler coined the term atmospherics, researchers had already begun exploring the potential of using in-store music as a sales tool. One of the earliest studies, Kane Smith and Curro, 1966, looked at the effect that music volume had on supermarket shoppers. Not surprisingly, researchers found that when the music was loud, shoppers tended to spend less time in the store. When the music was softer, shoppers tended to spend more time in the store. Interestingly, there was no statistically significant difference in the amount of money customers spent in each of those scenarios. Music volume only affected the amount of time people spent in stores, not sales volume. Then there's tempo. Tempo is one of the most important determinants of human response to music. The high impact of tempo, i.e. the rate of events in time, may stem from the fact that tempo is applicable not only to music, but to a wide range of experiential contexts. Humans acquire the ability to process tempo, the speed at which music is played, early in life. Before we can belt out do, re, mi, we can clap our hands to a beat. Fast, slow, it doesn't matter. We seem to have some innate proclivity for processing tempo. In the 1980s, marketing professor Ronald E. Milliman explored how stores might exploit our connection to tempo in order to influence customer behavior and, ultimately, increase sales. In his landmark 1982 paper, Using Background Music to Affect the Behavior of Supermarket Shoppers, Milliman revealed that fast, up-tempo music makes people move more quickly through a store and they end up buying less, while slow, down-tempo music makes people move more slowly through a store and they end up buying more. This makes a lot of sense. Slower music leads to slower shoppers, which in turn leads to shoppers having more time to discover and interact with more products. It is possible to influence behavior with music, but this influence can either contribute to the process of achieving business objectives or interfere with it. Mode. There has been criticism of the state of Western music, which for centuries now has been dominated by two tonal systems, or modes, major and minor. In lieu of a multi-paragraph tangent on music theory, let's take a super unsophisticated view of things and say this. Songs written in major keys generally sound happier or more positive than songs written in minor keys. A 2011 study found that you can fine-tune the background music of a store and optimize it for increased sales by paying attention to the modes of the songs you're playing in addition to the tempos. The best tempo/mode combination for boosting sales at a supermarket? Down-tempo? Minor. In other words, people buy more when there are slow, sad songs playing in the background. Given that both slow tempo and minor mode are associated with negative effect, sadness, music-induced sadness may well explain increased spending behavior in a shopping environment. Then there's genre. All of the supermarket studies researchers have conducted over the years have increased our understanding of how shoppers respond to different volumes, tempos, and modes of background music. But what works in one store might not work in another. At the end of the day, the genre of music you play might end up trumping all of those quantifiable characteristics we've been covering. Happy or sad, slow or fast. Some customers might just prefer reggae, or rap, or country, or Celtic music. A 1993 study pitted classical music against top 40 music in a wine shop. Turns out, when classical music was playing in the background, shoppers bought more expensive wines than when the top 40 music was playing. The study helped confirm earlier notions that background music should be aligned with the store's overall ambience. To quote the researchers, if consumers associate wine consumption with prestige and sophistication, then top 40 music may provide an incompatible cue. Regardless of the precise cause of the behavior, the takeaway here is that the genre of the music playing in the background did have a measurable effect on sales. However, unlike music's tempo and mode, which influence sales volume, the music genre influenced not the quantity of sales, but the quality. Listening to classical music didn't make people buy more products, it made them buy more expensive products. Conclusion. Noise will be noise. Retail soundscapes consist of more than just music, and in some cases they're completely void of music. But just because a store isn't pumping out the jams doesn't mean they aren't engaging in audio atmospherics. White noise is perhaps the most well-known variety of this non-musical background sound. It often takes the form of a gentle humming or hissing, like radio static. In office settings, the sound of people gently talking, aka office babble, is sometimes piped in as well. Because, as it turns out, silence can be unnerving. Customers need some kind of background noise to feel comfortable in a store, or any consumer setting for that matter. According to Julian Treasure, when it comes to satisfying customer eardrums, WWB works best. Wind, water, and bird song. New research published by the Acoustical Society of America seems to back up Treasure's idea that natural sounds for providing ambient noise like babbling brooks are good for worker concentration and satisfaction.
Music is a world within itself, with a language we all understand. With an equal opportunity for all to sing, dance, and clap their hands.
Stevie Wonder's Sir Duke introduces our local music news. It's an upcoming music concert. Would make a great Christmas gift, buying tickets to this event, by the way. And it's the ncsymphony.org advertising their pre-sale tickets on sale now. Phone 919-733-2750 or go to ncsymphony.org for more information about Dancing in the Street, the music of Motown. Saturday, March 21, 2020 at 8 p.m., My Mandy Concert Hall, Raleigh. You'll be dancing in the streets when you relive the magic of Motown. The program features smash hits made famous by artists like Marvin Gaye, The Four Tops, Lionel Richie, Diana Ross, The Temptations, and the one and only Stevie Wonder. Get ready to dance to hits including Ain't No Mountain High Enough, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, My Girl, Superstition, and many more.
There's Bessie Miller, Timo, and the King of all Sir Duke. And with a voice like Alice ringing out,
the Vince Guaraldi Trio's Christmas Time is Here introduces our jazz music news. It's an article entitled Classic Christmas Albums, Recordings That Always Make for a Cool Yule, published in Jazz Times 10 by Michael J. West on December 20th, 2018. Christmas songs may be the last true standards, a body of tunes that everybody knows by heart, even those who don't celebrate the holiday. Is it any wonder, then, that so many jazz musicians have taken a crack at them? Now, coming in number one on this evaluation, Vince Guaraldi's Trio, A Christmas by Charlie Brown. 1965, it's the most famous of jazz Christmas albums because it is as remarkably timeless as the TV special it accompanies. For one thing, it introduced the world to the now iconic Linus and Lucy, a.k.a. the Peanuts theme, as well as the warm, sentimental Christmas Time is Here, the song playing in the background right now. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this day back in 2014 that Who became the first to perform a concert on all seven of Earth's continents. And I gave as a hint, the performance on this day was held at the Argentine Carlini Station in Antarctica. Correct answer. Answer B. It was the heavy metal band Metallica who performed on this day back in 2014 in Antarctica, making them the first to perform a concert on all seven continents. As noted in Quora.com, Metallica did it in the same calendar year. That gave them the record in the Guinness Book. For Metallica, it was no easy task, though, sure. North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Australia, and Africa were givens. It was Antarctica that was the monumental task. Weather and terrain are big factors, so a lot of planning had to take place. Antarctica doesn't exactly have concert venues readily available for bands to perform, so Metallica performed in a large tent composed of scientists near the heliport of Carlini Argentine base on the Antarctic continent. And they played the show with absolutely no amplification, meaning all music was transmitted via headphones to all who were in attendance. And the answer to our second question, it was on this day back in 1960 that singer Fabian visited Elvis Presley at Graceland and did something unusual. What was it he did and why? Well, correct answer. Answer C. He lent Elvis his pants because Elvis had ripped his demonstrating karate. Fabian, an American singer and actor, rose to national prominence after performing several times on American Bandstand. He became a teen idol of the late 1950s and early 1960s. 11 of his songs, including Turn Me Loose, reached the Billboard Hot 100 listening. Elvis was first exposed to karate in 1958 while he was in the army and stationed in Germany. On one occasion there, he spent 9 straight days studying for several hours each day. As noted in the transition section of our today's program, this being the last day of John Lennon's life back in 1980, let's close out today's program with Lennon singing, Look at Me.
Okay? Yes, thank you.
Look at me. Who am I supposed to be? Who am I supposed to be? Look at me. What am I supposed to be? Look at me.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long. Until next time.